I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Memory is not a file cabinet. It's not a computer where information is neatly stored and easily retrieved. We are constructing and reconstructing our memories all the time. Our guest, psychologist Kira Green, suggests thinking of memory as the bricks in a Lego tower that we are constantly reassembling. She's co-author of a new book titled Memory Lane, The Perfectly Imperfect Ways We Remember. While our memories can be unreliable and they can be manipulated, they're also a key to our identity, including the decisions we make, the social bonds we form, our understanding of the past, and how we make sense of the world and our future. We'll talk about how memory has evolved to help us solve problems, why eyewitness testimony is so often wrong, how emotions affect memory, why we forget so many things, and why fake news and false memories can feel so real. Kira Green leads the Attention and Memory Lab at University College Dublin and joins us today on The Connection. Nice to have you with us on the show, Kira.
Thanks for having me.
I love this Lego metaphor that you use because it's an image that really does make a lot of sense when you think of bricks, I guess, as each discrete memory. Take us down memory lane, how that works.
So essentially what we're saying here is if you imagine that you are walking down memory lane, you're remembering the events of your life. The metaphor that we like to use here is that you shouldn't think of all those buildings as though they have like a preservation order on them, like they're, you know, they're kind of, you know, tied up there and nothing can ever change and no one's allowed, you know, move any bricks around. Everything has to stay the same. No, we would say instead that when you walk down memory lane, you should think about each memory, every kind of autobiographical memory, every event of your life as being like one of these Lego towers. And what that means is, when you, you know, take a stroll down memory lane and you remember events from your life, you're not retrieving those memories fully formed from storage. It can sometimes feel like that. It can feel like you've just uncovered a memory, but actually memory is a much more active process. So you're actually constructing those memories. You're building those buildings. You're building those Lego towers to create those memories. So we actually have a lot of agency in how those memories get constructed. And we're actively involved in it. It's a much more active process than we often maybe talk about or maybe have the feeling about.
Well, let's dig in a little deeper then. What are the influences that then shape and reshape our memories and how we recall them?
Well, there's a lot of different things. I suppose one of the kind of the key parts really is that a lot of our memories have an awful lot in common with each other. So I'm talking here in particular about autobiographical memories. So memories of the events of your life. You know, you got up this morning, you got dressed and you had breakfast, okay, and you got out and you got in the car and you went to work. And the chances are you have done some version of that every working day of your life, okay?
Indeed, and a huge that is true, overlap. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, so what we don't do essentially is encode every single one of those really similar overlapping memories as though it's all totally unique. We don't reinvent the wheel every time because that would be really wasteful. You know, it would be a very wasteful use of our quite limited cognitive resources to do that, to encode, you know, every bite of cornflakes in exactly the same level of detail. So instead, what we have is we essentially have kind of schematics. We have mental blueprints for what these kinds of events are like, and they're called schemas. And those are really just a kind of like a guideline for how this event usually goes. And those are very much influenced by our own personal histories, our past experience. Your schema for what a morning is like, for what breakfast is like, will be different to mine because my experience is different, my life is different.
As you describe that, I'm thinking of something, at least in the States, we call highway hypnosis, which is you get in your car, as you say, you go to work, you take the same route, you get to work, and you actually have no memory of what you did in that 15
That's
minutes
a really common,
to an hour.
Because and yet, you didn't crash the car. You managed to get home. No. You managed to stop at traffic lights. You didn't hit any you know pedestrians. You didn't like end up on the median strip in the middle of the highway.
Right.
You know, you managed to do everything correctly. So essentially, yeah, what's happening there is that we have kind of different parts of our memory that do different things, and we have parts the first, doing things very consciously. So, consciously, remembering, where you went on holidays last year or, things like that. But we also have a lot of our memory that's procedural. So, when you go to tie your shoelaces, you're not kind of having this really conscious, intentional thing about, right, well, if I can recall, when I was taught to tie my shoelaces, my dad told me that I had to put right over left. So let me just put right over left. You're not doing that. You have this very automatic, and it's almost like, it feels like muscle memory. We talk about muscle memory, but of course it's not in the muscles, it's in the brain. But, that idea of these very, what we call this procedural memory, these skills, these things that feel, that we're so experienced with, that they become so automatic that we don't have any conscious awareness of them. And that essentially is a lot of time what's happening when you're driving. That kind of, if you think of your mind as being like an iceberg, there's the part above the water that we have, where we have that sort of conscious awareness of, that we're really thinking about. But a huge amount of our cognition is below the waterline. It's that big part of the iceberg that we're not really consciously aware of. We can choose to direct attention to it if we want. So if you're driving home and you're doing that with the, big part of your mind that's not really paying conscious attention to it, but it's taking all the turns, it's stopping at all the traffic lights, it's doing everything correctly. But if you suddenly go, oh, I need to stop at the post office, right, you'll suddenly interrupt that kind of automatic process to change your normal pattern. So you remember to do something different instead.
So if our memories are, they're malleable, they're not entirely reliable, we're changing them, we're rebuilding them all the time. First of all, what is memory for? And how do we fact check our memories? And I have to say, reading your book, I felt like I almost trust my memory less now, having read your book, than before I began the book, because I began to sort of question things that I believe in my life that were true, but maybe they weren't. Maybe over time they've sort of decayed and become something else.
Yeah, they've kind of stretched to accommodate what you want them to be a lot of the time, rather than what really happened. So yeah, look, this is the thing. So our memories are very flexible, and they're flexible for good reason. We evolved these very flexible, very adaptable memories for a very good reason. It allows us to update information. So you learn something the next day, you learn something new about an event, you're able to update your memory of that. We're able to incorporate new knowledge. We're able to learn new things and incorporate that into what we previously knew about something. So all this kind of flexibility is essentially, it serves our survival. Throughout all of evolution, this has served our survival. And like anything else in our bodies or in our minds, evolution isn't about, like making something perfect. It's about making something that allows you to survive and allows you to thrive and reproduce. So it's not about, evolution doesn't have a goal in mind. It isn't saying, I want to produce a perfect filing system in the brain. That's not what it's for. It's there to help us survive. And one of the things that does that is that flexibility and that adaptability. But the flip side of that is, like you say, that sometimes when we reconstruct those memories, when we, build them along those kinds of, using those sort of mental blueprints that we have for events, sometimes the actual recollection we have isn't a totally accurate reflection of what really happened. So one of the ways that happens really commonly is you have that mental blueprint of, say, what your morning is typically like. And if this morning something slightly different happened, not something wildly unusual that captures your attention, but maybe you were in a bit of a rush and you didn't finish your cornflakes, or you picked up the spoon with your left hand instead of your right hand, or something small like that. When you go to remember that event later, you're going to remember it like informed by that mental blueprint, that schema that you have, and you'll have elided a lot of those. You'll have elided a lot of those details. You'll have forgotten a lot of those kind of little subtle changes that aren't really that important most of the time. And again, so most of the time, this is fine. Okay. We have this sort of mental digestion where you don't need to have, 365 memories of bowls of cornflakes clogging up your memory. This is not useful for you. Instead, you have a kind of digested core version that says, in the morning, I eat cornflakes.
And then you can kind of discard it and make room for new memories. But I am interested, though, in, is it then possible to fact check our memories? I mean, you can have childhood memories, and then you ask your siblings about something that happened, and then their memory doesn't jog with your memory, because their experience of whatever happened 30, 40, 50 years ago has been, if not contaminated, sort of changed over time. So do we sort of live in an approximation of the memories of our past?
We often are living in a sort of gray area. So sometimes there is external evidence that we can look for. So we can, you know, we can find that there's a photograph or there's a video or there's some documented evidence that supplies exactly what happened. Most of the time we don't have that. For our
Right.
normal day-to-day, you know, the conversation you had with your siblings in 1989, you know, like there's no video recording of
No.
that. So all you have is maybe three different accounts of what happened. And I think the thing to recognize is that none of those are necessarily the ground truth. Each of those is filtered through that individual person's beliefs, their previous memories, their subsequent memories, and their understanding about what happened and what it meant, how they interpret the event. All of those things are filtering how they will now report and experience it.
Right.
And you know, there's a thing where we all find where you have a kind of a, you know, various kind of myths or stories that you tell a lot, like family stories
Of
that you tell,
course.
or even just personal stories about the time that you got mugged on the street or whatever it is. And by this time, you've told that story so many times, you're not really remembering it when you say it. What you're doing is you're repeating the story rather than really reliving the actual event and describing it in detail.
What you also say is that in terms of sort of reconstructing these past memories, is that they do get altered by things that have happened in the present or the near present, so that sort of reconstructs what that memory is that is
Yeah.
constantly under construction.
So there's the term for this is interference, and there's two types of interference. There's proactive interference and retroactive interference, just to get really technical about it.
Sure.
So proactive interference is kind of that thing of I already know stuff, and that influences how I experience new information coming in, and it influences how I will then subsequently remember that and interpret it. Retroactive interference is you experience something, and then later on you get a piece of information that maybe contradicts or maybe adds something to your old memory, and that changes your memory. And that's part of that adaptive process of memory where we, you know, normally it's good that we can update our memories, but it can mean that we can end up with mistaken or distorted or false memories. So let me give you an example. So let's say you witness a car crash,
Right.
okay? And in the crash, you see a car drive through traffic lights and hit another car. Okay. And then a police officer comes to take your statement and they say to you, so how fast was the car going when it sped through the red light? Okay. Now there's two pieces of information there that may not have been in your original memory. The first is that the car sped, that's so that it was going very fast. And the second is that it went through a red light. Now, maybe it went through a green light, or maybe you didn't actually initially remember what color the light was. But the chances are that when you then subsequently recall that event, you're going to remember that the car was going fast and that it broke a red light.
I'll tell
So
you.
those are kind of details that somebody has given you after the fact, and those have distorted your memory. And a lot of the time, as they normally, when we take the, you know, most of the time when this happens in our lives, this is good. You know, as multiple people experience something and someone says it was the red light, and you go, oh yeah. And now you incorporate that probably accurate detail into your memory. And that's mostly good, mostly fine. But if that detail is incorrect, then your memory is now incorrect as well.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Talking with psychologist Kira Green, and she's co-author of a new book, Memory Lane: The Perfectly Imperfect Ways We Remember. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking with Kira Green. And we're talking about the mechanics of why we remember, why we forget. And again, she's co-author of this new book called Memory Lane, The Perfectly Imperfect Ways We Remember. You were describing this car accident that someone has witnessed and then being interviewed by the police. And all of a sudden, their memory of what happened begins to get changed, and new information changes maybe how they remember this particular incident, which gets to this whole issue of why eyewitness testimony and how it can be unreliable. I actually served on a jury a number of years ago, and you know, people put their hand on the Bible and swore to tell the truth, nothing but the truth, and we actually convicted somebody of doing something. But nonetheless, it does raise questions about how truthful a courtroom can be, knowing how unreliable and how malleable memory can be.
Well, first, I'm really jealous that you actually got to be a juror. I've never
I
actually
was
managed to be a
shocked,
juror.
and it was
Well, because
fascinating.
I got called once, but then, they take one look at you and go, "We don't want
Yeah,
psychologists in
no,
our jury.
exactly.
Thanks very much."
I didn't think they wanted journalists, but apparently they did. So anyway.
So no, yeah. So look, it is actually it's a serious problem, the level of distortion that can occur in eyewitness testimony. And there's some really scary statistics about this. If you look at, for example, if you look at in the US, if you look at data from the Innocence Project, which works to overturn convictions of people on death row who've been falsely convicted. So what they have is they have data showing, for example, a range of people who were originally convicted of very serious violent crimes, murder, rape, and so on. And then subsequently, evidence came forward to show that this person could not have convicted, have committed the crime, usually DNA evidence showing that there was a different perpetrator. So these people's convictions were overturned. And when they look at those original convictions, the vast majority of them, somewhere between 70 and 80% of those convictions were originally made on the basis of eyewitness testimony.
Wow.
So
Wow.
most of those miscarriages of justice came about because of flawed eyewitness testimony. And I
And
think it's
we should say, I think people testifying believe what it is that they're
Oh,
saying. It's not
absolutely.
that
And I think
they're
it's really important
lying.
that we understand that. It's not a matter of, and it's interesting because when you look at evidence of from, for example, judges who are asked, should we have expert witnesses to come in to talk about the nature of memory, the nature of eyewitness testimony. And they will say no, because it's common sense. It's up to the jury to decide whether or not the witness is credible. But it's not actually about credibility. It's not about whether that person is lying. It's about whether they are human. And just like every other human, their memory is subject to distortion. So really what we would say is like we should treat eyewitness testimony, just like any other form of evidence, just like DNA or anything else, which is that it's a useful piece of information, but it can be contaminated. Just in the same way that DNA or blood evidence can be contaminated, so can our memories.
This is a little bit of a weird segue, but I think it speaks to what you're talking about. You describe something called inattentional blindness. And there's a really fascinating experiment where there's a guy on a clown dressed in a clown suit on a unicycle who's sort of driving, bicycling or unicycycling through a particular area. And
This is
people are.
actually research conducted by Ira Hyman in Western Washington University, and it's great. So
It's, yeah, no,
inattentional
go ahead.
blindness
You
is a,
describe it. Yeah.
yeah. So inattentional blindness is basically a phenomenon where something can be happening right in front of your eyes, but you don't see it. Okay. It's actually quite common. Like there's some really famous like videos where you'd see, say, you have to watch people like throwing a basketball, and in the middle of the you have to count the number of the people in the white shirts, how many passes they make, and there's a team in white shirts and a team in black shirts. And while they're doing this, a gorilla walks in front of the camera and beats its chest, and people just don't notice the gorilla. Okay, so it's this really famous finding. So Ira Hyman and his colleagues said, right, well, let's try and do this in like a real world setting, like not with a video, not with it's really weird experimental things. Let's take a natural experiment. So they went to the campus of their university. And they literally just, stopped people as they crossed the main square of the campus and said, "Hey, did you see anything strange on your way across the campus?" And they'd go, "No." And they'd say, "Well, did you see the clown unicycling near the sculpture?" And most of them would say, "No." And the interesting thing was, because they were videoing this, they could see that people were actually looking directly at the clown and would actually have to like veer around him to avoid him, but they wouldn't notice. And moreover, those effects were much stronger among people who were using a mobile phone. Very high inattentional blindness if you're using a phone, because your attention is elsewhere.
Sure. And I do want to get to mobile phones a little bit later, but let me go back to some basic things. And you describe different kind of memories. I think we can relate to most of them. There's short-term memory, there's working memory, procedural, declarative, episodic, semantic. Are they all basically stored in the same part of the brain? And the hippocampus seems to be where a lot of memories are stored. Is that where they all are?
Not sort of. The hippocampus is where a lot of our memories are formed in the first place, but it's not necessarily where they're stored.
Interesting.
And the reason we know this actually is there was a very, very famous case study about a man called, well, he was known in the literature as HM, but his name was Henry Molaison. And he had had extremely serious epilepsy to the extent that this is in the 1950s. That his and he was so severe, he was having multiple seizures every day, like really, really life altering. And his surgeon said, "Look, as a last ditch effort to try and cure this, we're going to take out a chunk of the temporal lobe in your brain. Okay, the temporal lobe is kind of a bit sort of near your ears, kind of. So they took out a chunk of the kind of the that sort of part, but like near into the center, called the medial temporal lobe, that includes the hippocampus and the amygdala and a couple of other structures on both sides of the brain. And he survived and his epilepsy was cured. So great success. But the downside was, what they discovered was that Henry was no longer able to form new memories. Wow. So if you've ever seen the film Memento, this is what based on.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is the exact thing that it's based on. And very annoyingly in that film, they describe it wrong. They say, I have no long-term memory. That's not what it is. He does have long-term memory. He just can't form new memories.
Gotcha.
So that's what's happening, is that he cannot form any new memories. So anything that happened before the surgery, that's still there. His childhood, where he went to school, his friends, all of that stuff, that's still there. That's untouched, because those memories are not stored in the hippocampus. They're stored, they're distributed throughout the brain. But the parts that are still in the hippocampus is the ability to form new memories. So after we form new memories are essentially just connections between cells in the brain.
Right.
It's patterns of connections between cells. It's the network. And when we form those new connections, in the kind of the days and the weeks and months after we form a new memory, they over time, they start to kind of become independent of the hippocampus. They start to form connections with other parts of the brain, and they spread out and they get stored around throughout the whole brain through the kind of gray matter parts of your brain. But the ability to create those memories in the first place, that's formed, that is in the hippocampus. So if you remove that, you can't form any new memories. So HM, Henry, for example, you know, he would have met his doctors every day for years, but he would never remember having met them before.
Wow.
It would be like it was new every time.
Wow.
You couldn't remember what he had for lunch an hour ago.
Let me ask you a couple more questions about the brain. Brain seems to be at its maximum development in our mid-20s. That seems to be when things are mostly formed together. And I must say, as an older person, I often feel as if my hard drive is full, that there's just, I'm so packed with information and a lot of memories that I just can't seem to stuff more stuff inside of that. What happens to memory and the aging brain?
So I think what's a really valuable thing is to know that there actually isn't any upper limit on how many autobiographical memories you can store. There is no upper limit. Your hard drive is not going to get full. You don't need to delete information to fit more in.
Good to know.
You know, it will keep storing more and more information. We have yet to develop a computer that can be as flexible in terms of its storage capacity as our brains can. And a lot of that is because of this idea that memory is all about connections and associations,
right,
and forming new associations. Mm-hmm. It's not, a discrete piece of information stored in one place. It's connections. So in general, we know that the peak of our memory abilities, broadly speaking, tends to be roughly in our early 20s. But it kind of depends what kind of memory you're talking about. So if you're talking about, say, working memory, which is, say, like if I give you a phone number and I say, hold that number in memory and then dial it in a minute, that is working memory, the ability to hold a small amount of information in your mind for a short period of time. That's working memory.
Nice.
That peaks in our early 20s and then it starts to decline. But things like, being able to, for example, remember events from your childhood, remember events that have happened before, that actually, we see people throughout the lifespan who can do that incredibly well. One of the things that we see that's interesting, though, is when we look at memory, when we think of, say, looking back through memory lane, taking a walk down memory lane and remembering all of the events from our lives, you might expect that those events would be sort of evenly distributed over your life. That if I asked you to randomly pick 20 events from your life, they'd be, evenly spread over, however many years you've been alive. But actually, that's not the case. We have this sort of what's called a reminiscence bump. We have this kind of peak that we mostly tend to remember events from our kind of 20s and 30s. And we see that, throughout all different age groups, it goes, it's just this bump that that's the period of our lives that it seems to have the most impact on us in terms of our development and our identity. And those are the things that we remember. So this is why, like, my dad is constantly talking about the 70s,
The good old days. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, because I want to pick up on that. And again, Kira Green is our guest today on The Connection. And we're talking about her new book that she has co-authored with Gillian Murphy. It's called Memory Lane, subtitled The Perfectly Imperfect Ways That We Remember. Picking up on that, you say we tend to remember the good things. That mm-hmm. seems to be our default. We even sort of make ourselves the hero of our own memories.
Oh, definitely.
We tend to sort of make us maybe better than we are when we think about who we are in the past.
We definitely have a rose-tinted glasses when we think back on our own past.
Yeah.
So look, I mean,
and
this
why is that?
This is, of course,
why is that?
Well, so this is, of course, on the whole. On the whole, we tend to be more likely to remember positive events than negative events. We tend to remember, when we look back at things, we tend to remember that we were smarter than we actually were, more honest than we actually were, more generous than we actually were. You know, all of these things, we tend to remember ourselves in this with this sort of halo effect. And there's a lot of evidence that actually this seems to support good mental health, that people who have this sort of positive self-esteem and this positive view of themselves tend to be happier, tend to be mentally healthier. So again, if we come back to that evolutionary process, we know that good mental health is a survival thing. You know, people who have better mental health live longer, they survive better, you know. So there's a lot to be said for this sort of positive glow that we give to our lives. But of course, it's not always the case. I mean, we do, of course, remember very negative effects, events. We remember very traumatic events. If people who have post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, it's almost like an inverse, that they can't stop remembering the negative event. They'll have like intrusive memories of the negative event. And people with depression sometimes will be more likely to remember negative things than positive things. But on the whole, we tend to have this sort of a rose-tinted view of ourselves.
Why does a song or a smell trigger memories so powerfully? Again, they may not be correct, but nonetheless, we are transported back to that eighth grade dance and the guy that dumped us, or the guy that finally asked us to dance, and we're hoping he would do. How come that's so powerful?
So it comes back to this thing of memory being associative, that memories aren't just files. They're not files on a hard drive. They're not individual pieces of information that are, you know, you see in science fiction TV shows, you know, they're like, oh, you know, we dig into the brain and we removed that memory. That's not how it works. Memories are not discrete pieces of information. What they are is networks, is patterns of association. And some of these kind of events from our lives and some memories are more tightly linked with others than other ones are. Some of them are kind of, you can imagine it almost like a subway map, you know, when you've got like some kind of stations on the subway that are really tightly connected and really tightly linked. And there's like seven, there's lots and lots of different lines that all go into them. And others that maybe are out in the suburbs and there's only one line that goes out there and nothing else ever really comes to it. So a lot of the time you don't think about that thing, but then something triggers it. Something essentially puts you on that line down to that station and it triggers that memory. That thing that you haven't thought about in a long time. And smell can be a really, really powerful, and that's essentially has to do with the connection of where the olfactory bulb is and the brain's connected with the amygdala. Sure. With the amygdala. There's kind of a neuroscientific explanation for that. But essentially it's you know, we form these associative connections. So you smell something and you go, God, that smells like a hospital. And suddenly you're reminded of the time you went to visit your grandmother in the hospital. And you haven't thought of that memory in 10 years. But it's like it's put you on the train to that station that you never visit, that you almost never visit.
And smell, excuse me. And smell is such an early experience that we have as a baby, mm-hmm. right? It's just so filled with those early, hopefully nurturing years.
Yeah, well, I mean, like our early memories and our early experiences are really influential in terms of our, you know, like that kind of sensory context that we have. So like we generally don't have conscious memories of our very early years, you know. So it's called childhood amnesia, where most people, you know, it's not really possible to remember anything before the age of about three. And in fact, if there's people listening going, but I remember when I was 18 months
of course
old, you probably don't. That's probably a false memory. Like I have a memory of sitting on my grandmother's lap as a baby, but then subsequently I found a photograph and I realized, oh, I'd seen the photo, I didn't actually remember it, I was too young.
Well, I wonder, I mean, let me just jump in here. Then is memory then associated with language? So as we develop language, we develop the ability to remember things because we can call it, it has names.
To an extent, yes and no. I mean, these things co-develop, so it's actually very hard to separate them out, you know, because in a healthy brain, they co-develop, they happen at the same time. So, you know, correlation doesn't mean causation, you know, so it can be very hard to separate them out. But one of the things that that language does is it allows us to categorize our experiences. So to recognize the similarities among things, to put labels on them, to understand what they mean, to interpret them. So, for example, that's one of those things that will often happen, that people will remember something from their childhood and go, oh, now that I think about that, I interpret that totally differently to the way I understood that when I was a child, you know. And some of that is language, some of that, but some of that is also just experience, that you now have the context to understand what something meant when you didn't understand what it meant as a child.
Let me ask you about names and why it's so hard to remember names. I mean, when you think of names, they're just a jumble of letters that are put together that is somebody's name. But I'm also thinking...
That's exactly the reason. Yeah.
Well, okay, but let me just add to that, which is, and I'm sure this has happened to other people, certainly happened to me, is there are people you work with, you see them every day, and then all of a sudden you see them outside the office and you can't, it's like, what is
out of context.
What is their name? Is that state-dependent memory? I mean, the idea that you need sort of context in order for to make that association.
So there's two things there, and I think they're both really important. So one is, like, you're dead right, that names are just, you know, there's nothing special about this collection of letters, these collection of sounds. They're abstract. They don't have any inherent meaning. So a lot of people really, really struggle to connect this collection of syllables with, you know, somebody's particular face, particularly if it's a name that you're not familiar with, or a name you don't really know, a name that maybe is foreign to you. You know, you can really, really struggle to remember them because it's just a collection of sounds and you don't have a particular association with it. So a lot of people really struggle with that. And then people are always saying to me, like, oh, you know, my memory is terrible because I can't remember names. And I'm like, well, no, that's just because you're human. Like, that's normal. So we can try and work with those flaws in our memory. So to try and, you know, put those associations in place. So sometimes people will use strategies like imagining seeing somebody's name written on their forehead, or trying to come up with some sort of semantic connection, you know, with their name and like something about what it means, so that it has some association, some context that you can remember. But some people are just naturally better at it than others as well. There's just individual difference. But the other thing you mentioned is this idea of state-dependent memory.
Well, you know what? Only because we have to take a very short break. So hold on to that thought, and we will get right back to our conversation with our guest, Kiara Green. Again, she's a psychologist, co-author of this new book we're talking about, filled with fascinating stories about memory. It's called Memory Lane, The Perfectly Imperfect Ways We Remember. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Kiara Green. She's associate professor in the School of Psychology at University College Dublin, where she leads the Attention and Memory Laboratory. And again, we've been talking about her new book, which she co-authored with Gillian Murphy, titled Memory Lane, The Perfectly Imperfect Ways We Remember. Well, I remembered we were talking about state-dependent memory. Sometimes I can't remember from one minute to the next where we left things off, but talking about how important, I guess, context is in terms of remembering something that happened in the past.
Absolutely. And a lot of that comes down again to that idea of associations. So actually, the first studies looking at state-dependent memory, it was really cool. They looked at scuba divers, and they would get scuba divers to go down to the bottom of the ocean and learn, you know, some like a list of words, something like that. And then they would test them either on dry land or again on the bottom of the sea. And what they found is that they could recall the list much more accurately if they were in the same context, if they were in the same state. So if they were at the bottom of the ocean rather than on dry land. And we see that across a whole range of things. So this is where a lot of that stuff used to come around. I don't know if it was a thing in the US, but certainly when I went to school, they would say, you know, oh, if you're going to take your exam in your school uniform, you should study in your school uniform, because then...
Did that work? Then, did that work?
You know, it'll like trigger the memory. No, it's not quite how it works. You know?
Too bad.
But, you know, what we do find, though, there's, like, for example, like emotion really plays a role here. Like, so the emotional state that you're in when something happens, if you are in that similar emotional state again, you're more likely to trigger memories in that same state. So to remember the, you know, if you're, you, when you're very, very happy, it's easier to remember happy events. And this is kind of part of that idea of when people are very depressed, for example, they often really struggle to bring positive memories to mind. And it's that state dependent thing that, you know, when you're in that negative emotion, you have more of these connections, these associations with other similarly valenced experiences. So other negative experiences, and those will come very readily and very easily to mind, and you'll struggle to bring the more positive ones to mind. And one of our most common and most well-studied cognitive biases is that we kind of estimate how frequent things are by how easily they come to mind. So if positive experiences come readily to mind and negative experiences don't, you'll generally think, I'm a happy person, my life has been good, I've been lucky. If negative experiences come more readily to mind, you're more likely to think, well, my life is terrible, it's always been bad, it always will be bad. And that's very simplistic, of course, but
no, that's also very important. Let me ask you about traumatic memory. And there's a lot in your book about repressed memories, but also the McMartin case, a very famous case in America, actually, a number of decades ago, where children in a preschool accused their teachers of being part of a satanic cult. In the end, the children were not believed and the teachers were exonerated. And we could do a whole hour on that. In fact, in the past, I have done that. But it does raise questions about repressed memories, but also the idea of how memory can be influenced by things like leading questions, and you know, the idea that people can believe things that are not true.
Yeah. So, look, I suppose the first thing is to say is that there is no scientific evidence that memory repression exists. There's no scientific evidence for the existence of repressed memories. So I think it's what's important is, like I was talking about earlier on, right, memory, like forgetting, is a very, very well-established thing. So it's very, very common for something suddenly to remember something that you hadn't thought about in years. You know, it's like we're saying, you're on that train to the station in the suburbs that has no connections to it, and something you haven't thought about in decades, maybe, that comes to mind and you haven't thought about it. But that's not the same thing as this idea of memories being repressed. So there is this quite popular idea. It derives really from Freud's work about repression, this idea that if something is psychologically harmful, we repress it and we lock it away and we're not able to access it. And that was very influential in that sort of psychoanalytic model. But actually, you know, when we look at the science of memory, there is no evidence that memory works that way. So where this becomes very difficult is when we look at cases of people who have, you know, who feel that they have recovered memories, usually of childhood abuse. Now, I really, really want, before we say anything else, it's really, really important to be clear that child abuse does happen.
Indeed.
It's extremely common.
Indeed.
It's a lot more common than we might like to accept.
Absolutely, yep.
And I think it's very, very important that we make that clear, because when we talk about these things, it can be read as though you're saying people who come forward with historical abuse claims shouldn't be believed. And they should be. In the vast majority of cases, these are real things that happened. People have always known that that happened. They may not have thought about it much. They might have reinterpreted the events. They might now look back and go, when I was a child, I thought that was okay, but now I know it wasn't. You know, all that. There's also things people can have had memories for many, many years, but for very good reasons, didn't want to come forward with them because, you know, because of shame, because of the fear, or, you know, lots of reasons. So that's all very, very real. But what there is this subset of kind of recovered memories, of people who have retrieved memories of events that they say they had repressed and then that they'd never had any previous awareness of. And these are the ones that are problematic, because in a lot of those cases, there was often, so this is, there was kind of this
period of time,
memory wars, where, you know, memory scientists would have this big debate essentially with psychotherapists who were saying, oh, people are recovering memories of repressed memories of abuse. And memory scientists are saying, that's not how memory works. Mm. So, you know, that's not really, and what the evidence was suggesting was that in a lot of those cases, those were false memories, and that the people who were recalling them had often undergone very suggestive therapies, like hypnotherapy, or therapies where they were given drugs that make you very suggestible. and that the memories were essentially unintentionally implanted, and that they were remembering these events.
Well,
and sometimes these were really dramatic events, like people remembering, you know, all this kind of satanic ritual abuse.
Sure, sure. And what you're saying with repressed memories is these are remembering things that did not happen. But I'm also thinking that oftentimes when it does come to actual child abuse, the children are told, don't tell your mother, or, you know, this is our little secret, or if you do tell someone, I will kill you, or I will kill your, you know, your favorite dog. And I would assume under those circumstances, one could forget or sort of put into the unconscious something for survival, which is to say that I am not going to remember this thing, because if I do, I could put myself in danger. I could put my dog in danger. I could put my mother in danger.
That's the theory of repression.
Yeah, I mean, I've just heard people say, you know, I'd realize that something, this terrible thing had happened to me and I hadn't thought of it before.
So that what you're saying there, this idea of like, because it's dangerous, I'll lock it away. But that's the thing that there is no evidence for. And actually, there's been huge amounts of work really trying to look for that. But there's just no evidence. And we also, based on how we know, what we know about how memory works, there just is no mechanism that works like that, that locks away these events. But as that is not the, that's not the same thing as saying that these memories always have to have been in the forefront of your mind. We can have lots and lots of memories of things that we haven't thought about in years and years and years, in decades, and that something reminds us and it brings it to mind. We can also choose, we often choose just not to think about things. You know, something, you kind of go, oh, I don't want to think about that, and you move. And if you don't think about it a lot, you don't form that many associations with it, so it becomes sort of isolated and you don't access it that frequently. And then there's also that, as I say, that very important element of reinterpretation, that somebody, you know, that knows that something happened, and then later on they go, you know, that game that my uncle played, at the time, I didn't really like it, but I didn't think much of it. But now I know that was abuse, you know, and with the context of adulthood and of understanding, they can look back and say, I can reinterpret the meaning of that event. It's not that I have, you know, recovered a repressed memory, but I can reinterpret what it meant.
Because we have forgotten it. I mean, we literally, or we just do not think about it.
Both or either. So forgetting, absolutely, forgetting is it. So there is an important difference between forgetting and repressing. Forgetting is something we have, you know, a huge amount of neurological evidence for. We know exactly how it happens. We can very easily forget things. What we don't do is lock them away in this kind of cupboard where, you know, in order to protect our mind. That's a very, very popular idea, but it's actually not how memory works. And it's also the basis for this. There's this kind of idea of that has become quite popular in recent years, this notion of kind of the body keeps the score.
Yes.
This idea of, you know, that when memories are locked away and they're unconscious, that they somehow, the kind of the poison leaks out and it affects our lives. Again, they're just from a memory science perspective, there just isn't any evidence that that's how memory works.
And
a lot of people find it difficult to hear that because they think, you know, but this is feels like my experience, but there just isn't any evidence that that's how it works.
But you said earlier that we tend to remember the good stuff. I mean, that we, you know, make ourselves the hero of our own autobiography. So if we tend to remember the good stuff, then it would make sense that we put the bad stuff, the scary stuff, into some, if not a lockbox, at least some place where we don't have to be traumatized by it and feel bad about it.
Well, again, there's a difference between not remembering something and repressing something. Mm-hmm. This idea of there being this sort of, you know, kind of unconscious mechanism that represses memory. That's the part that we don't have.
Right.
That, like, you know, that there's, in fact, there's quite a lot of counter evidence against that. But certainly there is a difference there is in terms of the memories that we do choose to retrieve, you know, and we have quite a lot of agency and quite a lot of control over that. And a lot of it happens at a sort of set, like a sort of unconscious level. But when I say unconscious, I don't mean in the Freudian sense of unconscious, just that we don't necessarily have immediate conscious awareness in the same way that you don't have conscious awareness of how many times you stroked the toothbrush up and down when you brushed your teeth this morning. You just did it automatically, you know. So it's a very touchy subject. And I think we will talk about this a lot, you know, and I think it's we have to be very, very careful to recognize that this isn't just an academic debate. This touches on people's real lives and real experiences and very traumatic experiences that people have had. And you don't want to invalidate people's experiences. I'm a memory scientist, I'm a psychologist. So what I can talk about is what the evidence tells us about how memory works.
No, I hear you. And I agree with you. It's still a very controversial issue. Let me move on to a couple of things because I'm looking at the clock here. I'm curious about how technology affects memory. And I was recently on a trip and, you know, we use GPS to get to one foreign place after another. And I
bet you wouldn't remember how to get there later.
Well, exactly. And if you ask me, well, how did you get from X to Y? I would have absolutely no idea. And I'm thinking also about, our wonderful phones that we carry around with us, which are kind of memory devices at this point. I mean, you can so easily look things up. Is that affecting our memory, sort of how we remember how to navigate the world, how to retrieve information?
In a way. So what it's not doing is having any effect on the mechanism of memory. The fundamental mechanism of memory is the same. Okay. But the way we use different technologies and so on can interact with our memories. So, for example, when you use the GPS to navigate to a location that you haven't been to before, there's a much better chance that later on you won't be able to accurately recall that route. Okay. Now, that has nothing to do with your inability to learn spatial navigation. You know, your ability to do that is just the same as it was before. It's just that you've literally offloaded that task to a machine. And if you've done that, there's no need for your brain to do it too. So it doesn't double up. It doesn't duplicate the effort. Similarly, and actually, I think this is something that I've taken on board myself, there's something called the photo-taking impairment effect, where if you take a lot of photographs, you have fewer memories of the events you're photographing.
Oh, that's
so I always think of this when I see people with their phones up at a concert. You know, you paid 150 euros plus Ticketmaster fee to be at this concert, and you're watching it through a 3-inch screen. You won't have the memories of it that you would have if you just engaged with the experience. So those things, absolutely, they can change the way we interact with things. But that's the same as if you rather than choosing to hold a phone number in memory before you dial it, if you write it down on a notebook, it's exactly the same thing. You're offloading that. And then you don't choose to mentally retreat, to hold that 10-digit number in memory when you've just written it down, because you don't need to. Okay, so our brains are very flexible. They adapt to the need, and they don't tend to do things that we don't need them to do in that kind of sense with our very limited attentional resources. If we've said, by using whether it's a notebook or whether it's a computer or a phone, if you're essentially extending your mind and saying, I can use some extra storage here elsewhere, you don't need to duplicate that effort, and you typically won't. So that does affect, but as I say, it doesn't affect your ability to remember a number. It just affects whether or not you'll remember that particular one because you wrote it down or you put it in your phone instead.
Let me squeeze one more thing in, and I apologize for doing this towards the end of the interview, because I think it's such an important part of understanding memory, which are flashbulb memories. And you talk about September 11th. And I think if I'm saying those words, I think most people listening to us can reconstruct where they were, what they were doing, what they saw. On that terrible, fateful day. But you also talk about over time, those memories, and perhaps this is what we've been talking about, those memories begin to shift and change.
So I have an anecdote in the book of my memory of September 11th. I was in Rome with my best friend. It was our first holiday abroad when we were 18. And we came downstairs in the morning and, everybody was standing around. There was a TV hung up on the wall and everyone was watching the TV. And we said, what's happening? And they said, a plane hit the World Trade Center. And we all stood around and discussed it and what happened? And did the pilot have a heart attack? And, all this. And as we watched the second plane hit, I remember it so vividly. It's so clear. I remember what color skirt I was wearing. I remember where everyone was. It's like a flashbulb. We call these flashbulb memories because they're so clear. It's like a photograph. But some of your listeners might have noticed that there was an error in my memory there, which is that I remember this happening in the morning, but I was in Rome, which is a 6-hour time difference from New York. So everyone knows, and this is a crucial part of in terms of that post-event information, everyone knows and everyone learned over the many years since that the 9/11 attacks happened at 9 a.m. And I incorporated that information into my memory, where, of course, I must have had this experience at 3 o'clock in the afternoon But my memory is that it was in the morning and we were coming down for breakfast. So the message, I know we're running out of time, but the message from this really is that even when we have these incredibly vivid, incredibly clear, very emotional memories, they can still be subject to that kind of distortion and change over time.
Well, it's been a fascinating hour. Kiara Green, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Kiara Green and Gillian Murphy, co-authors of a new book called Memory Lane, The Perfectly Imperfect Ways We Remember. And Kiara is associate professor in the School of Psychology at University College Dublin, where she heads up the Attention and Memory Laboratory. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.